This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio program is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. The world's focus was on Washington, D.C. over the past weekend, with the inauguration of the unlikeliest of figures to the presidency of the world's most politically and economically powerful nation. On Friday, January 20th, actions under the banner of Disrupt J20 called for a general strike and various forms of disruption to the inauguration festivities. A day later, 500,000 people marched on the streets of the Capitol in the Women's March on Washington, D.C. Our correspondent, Chenjerai Kumanyika, was there and now joins us for a report back. Chenjerai is also an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University in South Carolina. Welcome back to the program, Chenjerai.
Hi, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
So first, let's talk about J20, Friday, January 20th, the day when Trump himself was inaugurated. Fairly early in the day, there were, as I mentioned, calls to disrupt the inauguration. What form did those disruptions take place on the streets of D.C.?
Well, the J20 protesters started out very early in the morning on Friday morning, and I was out there with them. They were out there as early as 7 a.m., and their strategy that they used this time was that they essentially blocked the checkpoints or stood and protested at the checkpoints so that people who are coming to attend the inauguration would have to walk through and see the protests that they were having and to see the signs about the issue of Palestine, about the issue of a fascist regime of governance that's incoming. And so they were very effective in disrupting the flow of people into the inauguration. At different times, there were so many people that, protesters really were kind of sort of blocked, and it slowed down the procession of people into the inauguration.
I understand in particular a contingent of activists from Black Lives Matter took over a checkpoint, chained themselves to one another and to the barricades there. Can you tell us a little, were you there? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that was simultaneously. So you had at the Blue Gate entrance of the inauguration, you had the J20 protesters. And then there were also J20 protesters up at the Red Gate. But Black Lives Matter, a very large contingent of D.C.-based Black Lives Matter protesters, essentially shut down that inauguration checkpoint. And so later on in the afternoon, or later on, yeah, towards the beginning of the afternoon, the J20 group went to meet with the Black Lives Matter group. And that was, let me just say, that was an incredible moment of solidarity. As the Black Lives Matter, as the J20 was walking towards the large Black Lives Matter group who was sitting there, you know, chained to each other in front of the checkpoint, the J20 protesters were chanting Free Palestine. And then they switched to a chant of Black Lives Matter. And the Black Lives Matter protesters switched to the chant of Free Palestine. And it was just a really positive moment. But yeah, though that checkpoint was completely shut down.
And so these sort of strains in the movement that converged on Washington, D.C. really represented the existing radical left movements that predates this sort of new chapter that unfolded, particularly through the Women's March on Saturday, right? I mean, do you feel that there was this kind of synergy between new activists and people who kind of, you know, had been woke for a while before, if you will?
Yes. No, I think you've got it right. It's interesting. I mean, you know, first of all, I mean, I'm talking about Black Lives Matter and J20, but there were so many groups there. We're talking about Friday now. I mean, there was, you know, you had 350.org, the climate groups. You had, I mean, just a, you know, even at the Blue Gate, where J20 was protesting, they were joined by a labor coalition, United Students Against Sweatshop Labor, and other labor groups who began chanting D.C. is a union town. And, you know, there was just this incredible coalition of different leftist groups who really, when you think about it, these are groups that most likely, if Hillary Clinton had won, would also have been protesting Hillary Clinton.
Right, and that is a really important point. So let's talk about the police presence on Friday. We heard that at the Women's March the next day, there were zero arrests. That's relatively true at Women's Marches throughout the country. But on Inauguration Day on Friday, what was the police presence like? And were there clashes between police and protesters?
There was tremendous police presence in all of these locations, but particularly strong at the Blue Gate, where I saw the J20 protesters. And then there were other groups, some J20 protesters, some Black Bloc groups and anarchist groups who were doing actions at different intersections in the general area of the inauguration. From what I understand, it was upwards of 200 people were arrested. I mean, I've heard the numbers as much as 270, but I can't verify that. But I did certainly, I do know that a lot of Black Lives Matter protesters were arrested. They were tear gassed. They were using concussion grenades and just shooting these grenades. And there's video footage of all of this that can be seen on Twitter. I think Unicorn Riot has a particularly disturbing incident where you actually see the police shooting one of these grenades like past a woman's head who's sitting there talking to the camera. So now there was also a permitted march on the inauguration day by the Answer Coalition. And that was a huge, I mean, just tens of thousands of people, almost reminiscent of something like the Millions March in New York. And they marched on inauguration day, just a huge group. But that was a permitted march. And so that was a peaceful march. And the Free Palestine group was, the J20 protests, from what I could see, were completely peaceful. There was this marginal sort of confrontation that happened not far from the Answer Coalition's march, a couple of blocks away. And, you know, you had a couple of people, someone had set a trash can on fire. I'm not sure if that was one of the anarchist groups or not. Someone said it was a police plant that may have done that. But, you know, again, these are all you can't verify these things. But what I do know is that was the main skirmish that happened. And that was really primary. People discussed it as violence. But I think that based on what I saw, I mean, I never saw anyone being physically attacked or anything being thrown at police. Police kept warning that there would be bricks thrown. So I think that once again, we have a situation where the destruction of property is called violence. And sometimes that headline can take over the dominant narrative, where most of what was going on was peaceful protests.
Now, Chenjerai, you said you never saw anybody being physically attacked. There's a viral video of the founder of the so-called alt-right, also known as neo-Nazi group, Richard Spencer, being punched by a person who appears to be aligned through his clothing with the anarchist Black Bloc. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, you know, I did see that video. I did not witness that incident in person. And, you know, this is tricky because, again, many of the people who are protesting are committed to nonviolent protest. And so, you know, the question is, What are we to make of this person being punched? But, you know, I tend to see that move as a self-defensive move. I mean, with the history of white supremacist violence and terrorism against people of color in this country, you know, and against groups that are progressive in this country, what are we to assume when we see a group who has explicitly declared that they are a white supremacist group encroaching, moving towards a Black Lives Matter group? We are in the midst of an incoming administration which is aligned with these alt-right groups and with a police force that is now, you know, you're in D.C., police that have shown that they're not going to protect Black lives and that they're hostile often to people of color in general and to protesters. I see a move like that as a defensive move. Should we wait until this person becomes like a Dylann Roof? I mean, we're not talking
until he sort of inspires other Dylann Roofs, even if he himself doesn't actually do anything, right?
Absolutely. So I think that I'm not here to sort of recommend what tactics people should use, but I will say that white supremacist group should expect to be preemptively dealt with when they attend these protests.
So let's talk about the difference between J20 and January 21st, J20 and the Women's March on Washington, D.C. You were there for both days back to back. The Women's March was eventually evolved into a response to the incoming Trump administration, drew, you know, 500,000 people, it's estimated. Possibly and probably a majority of women, but of course, lots of men and lots of even children and families. What was Saturday like and how different was it from Friday?
Well, you know, I mean, one difference was there was a lot of people out there on Friday the sheer number of people was unlike almost anything I've experienced. I mean, my guess is that, you know, the numbers of people might only be comparable to something like the Iraq War protests that happened in 2003. I mean, just the sheer number of bodies. I personally don't remember being around that many people.
This is on Saturday you're talking
about. This was on Saturday, at the Women's March. The energy was a little different. The energy was less confrontational, more celebratory, but definitely very determined. You know, I don't want to say that by not being confrontational that it wasn't a serious march. It just was that the energy was about promoting the messages that they're promoting, which there are a lot of different messages. And I got to say, it was quite a thing to see such a huge group, gathered in support of the kind of platform that the Women's March National Committee put together.
So let's talk about those people who were behind the march. Of course, this became such a giant event that I can imagine the behind-the-scenes discussions and decision-making also becoming relatively chaotic. I mean, after all, we're talking about, you know, people who are generally volunteering or working many more hours than they're getting any compensation for, trying to hold their stuff together. The march initially organized by white women who then invited women of color to join them, realizing that they sort of undermine their own message when it's not a diverse group putting it all together. I know that there were some sort of clashes between, say, people who were pro-Israel and the Palestinian rights contingents. Then there were some discussions and debates around whether to let so-called pro-life feminists join the march, if there is even such a thing as pro-life feminists. But Planned Parenthood and the National Organization for Women, these proudly anti-choice groups, were very much at the forefront. So did any of those kind of discussions, debates, or clashes come through on Saturday?
I did not see those debates, so they certainly did not evolve into anything that became a significant or noteworthy debate. The energy that was there was overwhelming energy of unity, although you had quite a diversity of opinion and issues there. Some people who are clearly passionate Hillary Clinton supporters, others who were probably Bernie Sanders, others who were, primary thing is not even electoral politics. So, you know, I mean, those concerns were there. You could feel it. I mean, you could tell there were a lot of first-time protesters there. And again, as a man who's attending the march, you know, in solidarity, I don't want to get into expressing too many opinions and sort of mansplaining what was going on. But what I've heard from people like Kianga Yamada Taylor and others is that while the concerns about, you know, the very liberal and democratic politics that where you would have people who didn't show up for Black Lives Matter, have not shown up in the past for vulnerable people, suddenly now in the wake of Donald Trump feeling like they have to protest, you know, I think that there's certainly some critiques and worries to be had about what that means. But what Kianga Yamada Taylor has said is that you can't dismiss any organizer who's serious cannot dismiss this massive amount of people who are ready to do something, ready to learn, ready to act. And that was clearly the spirit that happened on Saturday.
Right. I mean, better late than never, right? Better late Absolutely. To the movement than never at all to the movement. There was a really interesting photograph of one activist that's making the rounds of social media. Not sure which Women's March it was at, but this person held up a sign saying, "I'll see you nice white ladies at the next Black Lives Matter march, right? ? And I thought that was, sort of fairly polite way of challenging some of these sort of new activists, keeping in mind, sadly, that a majority of white women voted for Donald Trump. Probably those very women weren't at the marches. But clearly, if you think of white women as any kind of a homogeneous community, that is a community that has some work that still needs to get done.
No, I think you're right. And so that's what I'm hearing from the women leaders, is that this was a space where those kind of difficult conversations can be had. It just doesn't mean that we have to run away from them, but where folks are looking at how they can use that energy and that mobilization is happening to move forward. And I got to say also, I mean, there were a tremendous, I mean, I saw, this was a very, in terms of the attendance, it was very intersectional. There was all kinds of folks there from various ethnicities, ages, people with disabilities. I got to say, probably the march was not as accessible as it might have been, with that many people, but that didn't stop folks who were wheelchair users and other folks from coming. So it was not like, there was just a diverse group of people there, very diverse. And in D.C., and I know I can't speak to what happened nationally, but I know there was tremendous participation internationally, actually.
And those of us here in Los Angeles, where this program is based, are so proud to, have won the mantle of the biggest march happening in Los Angeles. It's estimated 500,000 people in Washington, D.C., 750,000 in Los Angeles. And for those who missed our special report from the Los Angeles March, you can get that, watch that on our website, risingupwithsonali.com.
So the numbers are in you. Did you all beat Chicago?
Oh, yes. As far as I can tell, we did, And it's certainly us Angelenos are feeling very proud of ourselves. So Chenjerai, finally, let's end with this issue and this question about if indeed, of course, these marches had a huge component of disappointed Democrats, disappointed Hillary supporters. Is the challenge of the left that predated the Women's March, is the biggest challenge going to be to make the case that pouring all of this energy into the centrist Democratic Party is the wrong thing?
Yes, no, this is a really tricky question. It's something that even at the DNC, if you look at the Socialist Convergence, they were taking up this question. I mean, you had the head of Bernie Sanders' coalition there arguing that but what Bernie Sanders has shown us is that it is possible to have a sufficiently leftist Democratic Party. But there are those who took the exact opposite lesson from what happened in the election. So I think this is certainly one of the true questions. In the meantime, one of the really interesting thing that has emerged is a website kind of base app called swingleft.org, which has begun to take a look at all of the Congress members that are vulnerable in the House of Representatives across the country, suggesting that this would be one strategy for people to try to take back the House. So you have that kind of opportunity, and yet you also have very different kinds of politics where folks are looking at the local level and looking at other approaches to politics through, much more grassroots or anarchist means. And so all those strains, these are the debates that are going to have together be figured out. And I have a sense that with the amount of people, I have a sense that each of these different approaches may, in the short term, have a lot of support.
Right. We know that former President Obama and his Attorney General Eric Holder are pouring their efforts into redistricting reforms. I mean, let the Democratic Party fight that fight, right? I mean, that is an important fight to fight, which is undoing the damage of the very unfair redistricting that the Republicans spend years laying the groundwork for and that they're now reaping the benefits of now. That was a tactical fight the Republicans won, and the Democrats should, those who are card-carrying Democrats should certainly take up that fight and win that fight. So the question becomes, should social movements pour their effort into that fight or leave it up to the party elites?
Yes, and what does that look like at different scales? Like, how does that play out at the local level? How does that play out at the state and at the national level? These are complicated questions.
Well, Chenjerai, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And of course, we will have you back on again in the future.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Chenjerai Kumanyika was on the streets of Washington, D.C. on Friday and Saturday, January 20th and 21st, and brought us a special report from there. He's an assistant professor of communication studies at Clemson University in South Carolina. He's also one of our news correspondents. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/RU with Sonali.